Booker Tov, Shavuot Tov. Hi, thank you. Firstly, wonderful to see everyone again. I feel a long break. And where's my child? Baruch Hashem, that child is feeling better, only to have passed it on to his older brother. So yes, the mumps. It's indeed the mumps. Is that? And I gave all my children boosters, and one of them still got it. Isn't that? Oh. Right. Correct. So they say it's saliva, which I was so careful, but the two of them share a room, and these are the two youngest ones, so a six-year-old and a three-year-old. Right. That's what we were thinking. 100%. This child, it's so much more swollen. He's in much more pain, and he has a much... Oh, the microphone isn't good. Oh. and he has a much higher fever. And many more symptoms. And I didn't think that was going to be the case. You know, once it's in the air, I thought, if anything... And six. My six-year-old has, and I was thinking... So now he's in incubation, and that's right, isn't it? The second one was more exposed. Right. Whereas he was exposed... He was living with it, so maybe that's why it's worse, but in terrible, terrible pain. I mean, the first one, I tell you, I couldn't tell that he had it, and even the swelling was there one day, gone the next day. Here, it's been since Thursday night, and still very, very not fun. I was thinking on my way here this morning, it's really been, you know, you asked HaKadosh Baruch Hu at the beginning of the year to have a healthy year, and it really has an effect on one's, again, mentality, but it's Rat Hashem. Yes, and in the end, Menachem Liebtag came. Because did you hear what happened? I called to confirm with her Tuesday night. I said, I just want to remind you, you said you would do it. She said, yes, I know. This was her tone. Remember my son who wasn't feeling so well last week? He's still not better. So I don't know if it was the mumps or not, but as of Tuesday night, her son, who was sick a week earlier, was still sick. So Tuesday night, I was running around trying to find a substitute, and Menachem Liebtag said he would do it. How was he? Yes? Okay, he said I'm going to... Oh. You see that? I treat you well. Again, I always say if I get a substitute, it has to be someone worthwhile. Yeah, you see that? No, I knew of different people to call, and I emailed a few people, and a few people responded positively, but once Menachem said yes, I said, okay, that was it. And can I tell you something also, and then we're going to start? He said he enjoyed it so much. He said, Shani, can you get me a job in Matan for next year? So, yes, talk about, so it could even be that I may have to lower my hours next year and only teach one class next week. So I told him that I would go to the office and ask, what do you think? Yes? Yeah? Okay. Okay. Wonderful. Okay, today is actually going to be a very positively oriented class as we finish our Masa HaAmim in Yishayahu and actually start the second half of Yishayahu, which you're going to see is not only much more historically oriented, we're going to get back to the time period of Chizkiyahu, but also, especially at the beginning, is going to teach us some new themes that we saw hints of beforehand, namely Yeshuot and Nechamot, some of the prophecies of salvation. And here we're going to speak about the exact opposite of what we saw in the previous chapters of Yud Aleph Yud Bet, when Yeshayahu is foretelling destruction. How imminent is that destruction? So too, we're going to have to ask the question with regard to the salvation. What type of salvation is he speaking about? Even if, you recall, in the Masa HaAmim, even within the context of the different nevuot that he's going to deliver to the nations, we discussed, in fact, that it's not so clear that he's speaking for that generation. As a matter of fact, it's clear that he's giving an eschatological view, probably one that was recorded by his students and maybe not even recited by himself. So with this, we're going to continue, and we're also going to see different stylistic ideas of Yishayahu that have already portrayed themselves here and there, but we're going to see in a much more, again, we'll see it in an emphasized fashion very shortly. So if you recall, we're in the midst. We already finished Perek Tedvav Tetzayin. Right, if I recall correctly. Chaf even. Excellent. Okay, yeah, because we're going to focus on Perachaf Bet. And now, when we take a look at, that's right, the last section of Chaf, if you remember, we discussed the symbolic aspects of Nevuah. Yeshayahu has to walk around barefoot. And we said, we meant to take this literally, the Rambam, Maimonides the rationalist, will tell you, certainly not. This is a figurative message. A message, in fact, of the very idea of people going into refuge, barefoot, get naked, or trying to show the slave mentality, whereas those like the Abarbanel of the 14th century are going to argue, if God told a Navi, despite the fact that this looks like a mocking affair, God told a prophet to give over this prophetic message, to relay it in such a way that the people are in fact going to internalize it, then don't be shocked by a scene such as this, as the Navi walking around barefoot and without clothing for the different years, as you see, for Shalosh Shanim as an ot u'mofet. These two words, I don't know if Menachem mentioned this in the context of Karban Pesach. But the idea of ot u'mofet, which first appears in Sefer Shemot. Again, then we find that the term of ot is meant to be a sign specifically for Am Yisrael to instill belief, whereas mofet in Perakhaf, Pasuk Gimel. Wherein a mofet, just to remind you, is meant to serve as a sign for different nations. It could be including Am Yisrael, but that's more to wow, to awe the people. So in fact, the Abarbanel would argue here, you see, the whole point is to have an effect on the people. And as bombastic as the scene sounds or appears to us, that's exactly how it's going to instill, number one, belief in the people, and secondly, it's going to instill a sense of awe in the people as they see a messenger of God walking around this way to give them this message to Mitzrayim and Cush that this is exactly what's going to happen. They're going to be taken out as slaves, again, barefoot and nude, out by the kings of Ashur, which we know actually does happen. Again, it's going to take about another 40 years for this to take place. And then finally, the empire that, as we know, the Plishtim we're relying upon, that Yisrael is going to rely upon, this Egyptian empire is going to fall. Va'amar Yoshev ha'ihazeh ba'yom ha'hu, hine chom mabateinu asher nasnu sham le'ezra lihinatzel mipnei melech Ashur ve'ech nimalet anachnu. They're going to look at Mitzrayim and say, oh my, how are we going to be saved by Ashur now? The powers of Mitzrayim are going to fall. Now, interestingly, this theme of don't rely on Mitzrayim, it's a continuous theme, not only during the time of Yeshayahu, we know earlier prophets as well. We know from the time of Yetziat Mitzrayim, part of the challenge is to get Egypt out of our system, not just to get us out of Egypt, but the whole idea of Egypt being a major world empire for thousands of years was always relied upon then as the ally of the underdog. If anyone ever needs help, because Mitzrayim is always going to vie not only for power over the area of the Nile, but also over the ancient Mesopotamian area. And therefore, what's going to happen is that whenever we need someone to help us or to save us from the various Mesopotamian nations, it's going to be Egypt that's going to be relied upon. And this is exactly what Yeshayahu is going to say in very clear terminology. You don't want to rely on Mitzrayim because as great as they seem now, that is exactly how much they're going to fall. Precedent established by Yetziat Mitzrayim, again during the time of the fall of Ashur. And keep in mind, Yirmiyahu's major challenge is once again going to be against Mitzrayim. He's going to be quoting, ironically, verses from Yeshayahu, almost verbatim, from these Nevuot, giving us a sense like, Ezra, again, just like by the time period of Ashur, it didn't pay to rely on Mitzrayim. I'm telling you, now that the Babylonians are in charge, Yirmiyahu's going to say 100 years later, it doesn't pay to rely on Mitzrayim once again, because we know the Babylonians are also going to come in a very similar fashion and destroy the Egyptian empire. And we know that the cycle continues. Egypt is going to be conquered, and then they're going to regain their glory, only to finally, during the time of the Babylonian empire, have their glory once and for all, finally stripped from them. So with this, we continue. After seeing the embarrassment of Mitzrayim, we should not rely on Mitzrayim. That's right. By the way, I don't know if you remember this, the King David Accords, these psukim were quoted over and over again. Why Mitzrayim? If there's any nation that the Nevi'im repeat in terms of never having an alliance with him, you have to remember, Ashur is long and gone, the empire of Aram is gone, Mitzrayim is still here more than any other nation that has spoken against having an alliance with them. It's definitely Mitzrayim. Can't tell you anything about the U.S. of A. from Tanakh, but again, Mitzrayim is certainly not the ally that you're supposed to seek. And with this, we continue then to what we're going to see, the peripheral nations. In this case, they're going to be called the different nivuot that are given to Midbar Yam. Gana to the different nations that are going to be found, again, on the periphery of Eretz Yisrael. And there are various, as we're going to see, various nations that we haven't necessarily heard of throughout Tanakh, but they're going to be mentioned here slowly but surely. Each one is going to be given their own little section. Again, first the Midbar Yam, referring to all the different nations of the desert and of the seas. And Midbar Yam is really going to be specifically a little bit of a nickname for the area of, again, the Syrian desert. Again, in Perek Chafalev, chapter 21, Masa Midbar Yam. Bavel, very nice. So Sansina was going to explain it as Bavel, just like Rashi does. Why? Where's the Midbar? The Midbar is, on one hand, we have it towards the eastern side of Eretz Yisrael. We also have Midbar, where else? Again, the Israelite in the south. And we also have Midbar. We were not going and continuing to the north. So sure enough, who or which nation came from the southeastern area and then over the course of about 40 years made their way all the way up to the Assyrian area? This is Bavel. So there are some, in fact, like Rashi, who will interpret this as a nickname for Bavel based on the fact that it traveled throughout this entire desert. And it's also called the nation that rests upon Mayim Rabim, the nation that rests upon great waters. Which waters is it eventually going to rest upon and establish its empire? The Euphrates. And therefore, it's also known as Midbar Yam. Right? That's how many Parshanim understand this. Again, because it's going to make its way, or they'll make their way to Nachal Prat. And yet, others explain that these are not just referring to the Babylonians, who started off as the Chaldeans in the southeastern area of the desert. Then they made their way up to the northern part of the desert. But actually, this is a reference to all the different ethnic groups that are in that area, who constantly, we know that whether it's Midian, and we're going to see other nations of the Arav, again, of Western nations in general, that are going to cause problems to Eretz Yisrael, that this is who it's referring to. Right now, the major threat is obviously going to be the up-and-coming Babylonians. But we can't call them Babylonians yet because they don't exist as Babylonians. They haven't established their empire in ancient Babel, in ancient Babylonia. So right now, they are really Kastim. They are Chaldeans. So with this, we're going to see what are the nivuot that are going to be offered them for the next 10 psukim. The Masa begins, Masa Midbar Yam, Ksufot Banegev Lachalof. What do? They come all the way from the Negev, and they come, again, in almost a stormy fashion, right? They come with their armies, and they just pass by. And this is exactly how the Chaldeans rose to fame. Through what? Geno hu gadli ha bogeid bogeid va shodeid shodeid alei elim tsuri madai. This is how they come. They come as shodidim. They come as bogdim. Shodidim are those who pillage. That's right. Are those who rob. These are basically the desert pirates. Very nice. They just come in. Who else is this told about? For those who remember in Sefer Shoftim, the time period of Gideon, these were the Midianim, the Midianites who came in a very similar fashion. They just come. By the way, what is their major animal that they managed to domesticate? The camels. Excellent. And with their camels, with their camels, they come, and the Chaldeans the exact same way. That's the animal of the desert. And they come and they attack people. Again, today we would consider the group very similar to the Afghani tribes of today that just come, and that's how they conquer. That's how they wipe out different nations across the lands. Kol anchata hishbati. Right, and sure enough, this was accompanied, as you can imagine, by a lot of anachot, by a lot of different sighs that were here. Again, a lot of the pain that accompanied it. But don't worry. Al kein mal'um matnai chalchala tzirin machazuni ki tzirei yoleida naviti mishmoa nifhalti mirot. And now come the pangs of childbirth. And we know that the pangs of childbirth are always, on one hand, going to be gripped with a fear, going to be gripped with the unknown. What's going to happen? Is the outcome going to be positive? Is there going to be a child? Or, again, the outcome, as we know, can very often lead to death. And this is a phrase that Yeshayahu seems to love, the idea of childbirth, of chevlei leida. because it certainly has the connotation of a tremendous amount of pain, but at the same time not knowing what one should be anticipating thereafter. And with this, he continues and says, again, that's why I'm going to tremble right now like the woman who's in the state of childbearing. And my mind is now confused. I'm panicked. Right? My night of pleasure has turned to terror. So now, again, what does this mean? Set the table. Let the watchmen watch. Eat and drink. Please keep this idea in mind. Up the officers. Go, go, mishchu magen. It's time to grease your shields. What is this trying to tell you? What does it mean? Go and eat and drink. This was a very common philosophy. Eat and drink because tomorrow you may die, right? And this is exactly the idea that's portrayed over here. Again, there's fear. We don't know what's going to happen. Again, the whole idea over here, the people are coming from the Negev, and they are coming, and Hashem says, don't worry, the anachot, the sighing is going to stop, because now it's time for the chavlei leida, time to eat and drink. Tomorrow we may die. At the same time, we're going to go out and prepare for war. Because Hashem has said to me, says Yeshayahu, go up, go and tell the scout, tell him to announce what he sees. What is he going to see? Sure enough, he sees all these people coming. They're coming with Rechav Gamal, Vihikshiv Keshev, Rav Keshev, the riders on camels, and he's going to listen closely. When are they going to come? Vayikra Aryeya Mitzvah Adonai Anochi Omed, Tmid Yomam V'al Mishmerti Anochi Nitzav Kol Halilot. And like the lion then, he is going to call out. He's going to say, I stand on the lookout of Hashem. Every day I watch, every night I watch. Pasuk Tet, Vihine Zeba Rechav Ish, Tzemet Parashim, Vayan Vayomer Nafla, Nafla Vavel, What is the scout going to say? Again, I'm going to stay at my watch. I am not going to desert my post at all. I am confident. Generally, what does the scout do when he sees the enemy getting closer and closer? He's going to, that's right, to retreat. He's going to leave his post. Again, Yeshayahu says, come, watchman, what do you say? What do you hear? Don't give up your post. Watchman says, no, I'm devoted to God. I'm not going to give up my post. And Yeshayahu says, raise your voice. Tell everyone what you see. And he says, this is so strange. What do I hear? What do I see? Again, here I see the horsemen coming. And then all of a sudden, they're fallen. All of a sudden, Babel has fallen. And this is, by the way, the idea of this is Babel, but as I said, the Midbar Hayam can represent all the different nations of the desert, but right now the Chaldeans, giving us the sense that did Yeshayahu actually write this during this time? Does he write this in 705 BCE? No, the Chaldeans are not even around until the years of 620 or so BCE, and therefore it's going to take about another 90 years for them to come, giving us the impression that even if he saw them, again, either he didn't mention Babel and later his students wrote in. They basically added in the terminology of Babel, or he himself knew about the up-and-coming nation of Babylonia, and it's going to be transcribed for future generations. Because it wouldn't be relevant right now. Meaning the people don't need to hear who these Babylonians are. He could definitely talk about the Midbar Hayam, the various nations of the desert who consistently attack Am Yisrael without mentioning Babylonia. Meaning it's like mentioning a made up, you know, the land of Oz, right? No one even knows who that is because they're not even on the map yet. But they will know, giving us the impression that he could have mentioned all of this, transcribed it to his students. His students aren't going to reveal these nevuot until years later. By the time Tanakh is canonized, are these nevuot already known? Certainly so. Yes. Right? But even if Yeshayahu did deliver it, or did receive it, in the 705 BCE or so, he probably did not relay it to the people because it wouldn't have been relevant for them to hear. And the different possibilities that we mentioned at the beginning. Or he mentions it, but without the terminology of Babel, because they don't even know who they are. So it would make more sense, even if he did hear it, to put it in hiding until the students were recognized when such a prophecy really would be relevant for an audience. So that's what he's going to wait for. Those are the two different possibilities. Very nice. Yeshayahu loves this terminology. By the way, he uses it, again, more than any other Navi. Right? Why, by the way, what do you already know? Again, this is a theory that definitely is supported by the first few chapters of Yeshayahu. What do you know about Yeshayahu's own relationship, not so much with his wife, but his children? His children are very much part of his nevuot. And it seems even before he has the children, he's already told what to name the children. And the children are a depiction of the future of Am Yisrael. Remember Immanuel, Maher Shalach Hashbaz, Sar Shalom, and Pela Yoetz. So we have all these terminology giving us the impression even that perhaps witnessing the birth of his children, he definitely understands this, that the next generation, meaning this idea of childbirth, is such an appropriate metaphor for that transition. And on one hand, there's awesome fear that's accompanied by a childbirth. Please keep in mind that it's not like today, where, by the way, women still enter into a state of fear. But you have to remember that mortality rates of childbirth were so high. So you're going to be gripped with fear and with a tremendous amount, this is before epidurals, with a tremendous amount of pain, right, at the same time. Again, and it's a perfect, I know this is going to sound funny, but it's a perfect position that depicts, again, the greatest insecurity. How did women used to give birth? Standing up, squatting, al ha'uvnayim. Again, picture two slabs of stone on either side. Again, if you can picture a birthing woman, what does she look like then as she's giving birth? She's stuck down, and imagine a contraction just for a moment. Again, her whole body is shaking, right? And she, you know, just picture this up and down. What does it look like? It looks like, if you didn't know that she was in labor, someone who, again, it's just barely managing to support. Again, you know, in hospitals, when they tell you for natural childbirth, go around and take a walk around the hospital. And I remember this, you know, in the middle of a contraction, you just feel that you're going to fall. You, I always found myself leaning over the banister in Hadassah Haratzofim, right? Just, okay, you know, I have to hold on for dear life because the contraction, again, is just bringing everything out of me. That sense of you're in a state of tremendous vulnerability, not knowing what's going to happen thereafter. So it's fear, it's anticipation, it's the anxiety, and perhaps because Yeshayahu is really that transition figure between the generations where the children are going to be so significant that he's much more sensitive to the childbirth. That's what I think is specifically his reason here. Oh, who's he speaking to? He's speaking to the entire audience. Right? We said it could be he's even speaking to other nations, but they're definitely going to hear about this. By the way, can everyone relate? Even men, can they relate to this phenomenon of childbirth? They've witnessed their wives in childbirth, and they know that fear, the fear on their face. Again, there's nothing like it. My husband always says he doesn't know how to react when I'm in childbirth because I Baruch Hashem, I don't scream, I don't do anything. He says, but the pain I see on your face, I never see such pain. I said, yes, but don't worry, because what type of pain is it? It's the pain that you know Be'ezrat Hashem will bring along the greatest happiness, right? But the truth is that they didn't know, right? And this is exactly what he's saying. By the way, he uses this metaphor a few times. We're going to see it each time. He already used it once before. Do you remember in Perek Yud Bet, the same idea of being gripped with fear, of also that sense of vulnerability, of the chavlei leida, but don't worry because good things are going to come thereafter. He's also going to use this term primarily. He's talking about labor, again, before the last stage of pushing. Right, again, today we would call it, right, the active phase of labor, right, meaning transition, active phase, and then comes the pushing, right, itself. So that's exactly what he's going to mention, that sometimes the process takes so much strength out of us, but koach en la leida, that then comes the pushing, meaning you're ready finally, the contractions are more or less over, and the baby's ready to come out, but what happens? Have no strength. And this pasuk always comes to mind during childbirth. I don't know how many women relate to it as well. And now women talk about like a Motzei Shabbos childbirth, right? You just finished cleaning everything up from Shabbos and your body is exhausted. And then you go into labor and you don't have a choice. You have to handle the contraction one after the other after the other. And then the midwife says, push, and I can't. I just can't. Right? Meaning, I just did 20 loads of dishes. I can't. I just can't push. Right? And that's the sense that Yeshayahu speaks about. What happens after all that? And then you don't have, can't even bring yourself to the next stage. And we're going to see exactly what time period he's talking about. Right now, though, he's talking about here, we're gripped with fear because who's across our borders? Call them Babylonia, call them all the ethnic desert nations. And we don't know what to do. The watchman, again, he's going to be confident. Lo and behold, what does he cry out? Oh my gosh, they're falling, they're falling. Nafla, nafla, bavel, v'chupsi le'elava, shibala aretz. It seems that people, and we know this certainly, in Egyptian culture, they used to take their gods out to war with them, or at least images of their gods. Their gods are gone. Medushtim uven garni asher shamati meit Hashem tzvot elokei Yisrael higatzati lachem. He says, I'm telling you, I heard this directly from God, and now I'm sharing it with you. So you have nothing to be afraid of. You're going to go through the stage. You're going to be gripped with fear, but what's going to happen? What type of childbirth is this going to be? Is it going to end up okay? Yes. Again, go out to war. Everything's fine. So far we've had the Masa now that's given, telling us about the destruction of these Midbarei HaMidbar, the Amei Midbar VaAmei Hayam. Now we're going to speak about, as I mentioned, the other peripheral nations over here. This is Masa Duma. The Masa of Duma. Who is Duma over here? Av Pasuk Yud Aleph. Very nice. So here we have nicknames for all these different nations. Midbar Yam is a reference to Babel, and the very fact that we're going to see within the Nevuah itself different names are going to be mentioned. But in fact, Duma seems to be one of the names mentioned in Sefer Breshit. If you look back in Perek Chafei, one of the children of Yishmael. And sure enough, we know in the northern Arabian Peninsula, there really is, till today, a place called Dumat El Jandal. So Dumat, again, seems to preserve the name of the place. And this area is actually part of Saudi Arabia of today, this area of Duma, again, near the Jordanian border. And the very fact that he then says, Eli Korei Mi Seir, giving us a sense that someone is coming from Seir. This is from the land of Edom. So if you picture, really, it's on the border of Edom, of Jordan and Saudi Arabia, that Duma apparently was a big province of their own, again, on the northern border of Seir, and this is what we're afraid of right now. Again, talking about the different nations of Edom. And this is what we're going to continue with as we take a look in Pasuk Yud Aleph. These are the people who have either conquered or have attacked or are trying to. What's going to happen to all of them, one after the other? What of all the Masa? You're all going to fall. Again, by the way, in most of these cases, who's going to be defeating them? Assyria. Right, again, who is the up-and-coming nation right now? But don't worry, because he's also spoken against Assyria, that Israel ultimately will conquer Assyria. Assyria is going to fall as well. So he's talking about the rise of all these nations against Am Yisrael, and then the fact that God is going to punish them for harming us. And that's exactly what we see here. Eli Korei Mi Seir, a call comes to me saying, Shamor, Mami Laila. Notice, by the way, the parallel here. Now, Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11, in the same chapter, in chapter 21. Thank you. Shomer Mami Laila. We just heard of that scene of the watchman, meaning he's going to be, again, the persona through whom we're going to hear the various news that takes place. He's going to say, Mami Laila. So tell me, what's going to happen tonight? Mami Lil. What's going to happen? Meaning, giving us a sense that we're under attack. That's why there's a watchman here. Amar Shomer, ataboker vegam Laila, intavayun be'eyu shuvu etayu. Morning came, and so did night. Again, keep on inquiring, come back again. Meaning, yes, we're under attack, I can't tell you anything yet. Sure enough, what happens? Again, I can't tell you anything yet. Meaning, they're attacking, but are we really under such terrible threat? Apparently not. So note that right here, we have a mention of Duma, who's coming to attack, but are they really such a major threat to Am Yisrael? Apparently not. But without us hearing of a major victory, as Esther just said, that seemingly is what we're anticipating. Take a look, and what happens? One pasuk later, new masa. Again, masa ba'arav. So what happens here, this idea of a gam laila? Why don't we hear what happens to this area of Duma, to this area of Seir? So many interpret that really, again, Duma even comes from the terminology of, what does it sound like? Dome, very nice, sleeping, yafed, or silent, vayidom. Giving us an impression that really the idea is that they're always going to be. Again, Duma is going to come, but ultimately nothing's going to happen. They're going to threaten an attack, but as we see here, nothing is going to happen at night. Come the morning, no, nothing's going to happen. Come the night again, no, nothing happens. Basically, are they really a threat? No, why call them Duma and not Seir? Because they're really Dome. They're a silent threat, nothing to worry about. The watchman is going to tell us, just forget about it, ask me tomorrow. You want to hear about Persia. So let's take a look at Masa Ba'arav. Gana Ba'arav, this is talking about all the Arabian Peninsula over here. Homa, we know, if we think about this geographically, so we're now referring to, obviously, the southeastern borders of Am Yisrael. And with this, we take a look in Pasuk 13, Yud Gimel. Bayar Ba'arav Talinu, a play on the word, obviously. And here, in the Ya'ar, in the Arav, again, within the area of the Arava, the dry lands, you're going to stay. Or Chot Dedanim, all of you caravans. Lekrat Samei Hetayumayim, you're going to meet all those who are thirsty with water. Yoshvei Eretz Tema, those who are in the lands of Tema. Balachmo Kidmon Nodeid, you're going to greet all the fugitives with bread. Why? Kemipnei Charavot Nadadu. You're going to recognize how everyone is going to be trying to escape the sword. Before the sword, before the bow, that straw, before the stress of war. Meaning, here, the southeastern area, please keep in mind that in ancient Near Eastern Mesopotamia, where did most of the military action take place? In Mesopotamia, between the two rivers of the northeastern areas of Eretz Yisrael. This, we're now talking about the southeastern areas. Are they going to be directly affected? Are they really going to be involved within the clash of the empires? No. That's why they're portrayed as those who are going to be meeting people from war. And when they see all those who have gone up trying to wage war and then they come back as fugitives, what message does that send to the lands of Arabia? Don't mess with them. Right, meaning that they're always, and we know this ironically, that really the southeastern Arabian lands never vie, right? They never really make it up to the same level of the empires of the northeastern area. And therefore, this is really a warning to them. Again, do you see what they're coming from? They're coming from war. Again, don't even try. Don't mess with all of the military clashes that you're going to be exposed to. Because you're not going to win. Instead, you're going to see all those who were themselves vulnerable. So here we have, obviously, the peripheral nations, as I mentioned, who aren't going to serve as a direct threat, but they are threatening to Am Yisrael, and the Navi is trying to tell them, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. Right? Don't even try, because you're going to see all those who are much stronger than you, all those who are failing. Comes along now, the last pasuk, Ki ko amar Hashem, Ki ko amar Adonai Eli, Ba'ot shana kishnei sachir v'chala kol kvod kedar, in another year, like the years of a hired laborer, all the multitude of kedar shall vanish. Who is Kedar? Kedar was one of the famous Bedouin tribes that went through the southeastern area of Arav. That's who it's referring to. Again, very similar to Midian. Kedar is from Bnei Yishmael. Anna, they would go up and down the desert. Hashem says, within a year, you're all going to be gone. Meaning, shame on you. You shouldn't really be part of these attacks. Whoever remains, Usha'ar Mispar Keshet, Yiborei Bnei Kedar Yimatu. Whoever remains, what happens then when you have a dwindling ethnic group? You're all going to be very few in number. Ki Hashem Elokei Yisrael Diber. This is what God said. So notice that. Are they necessarily going to heed the warning not to go and continuously attack? No, they will attack. And what's eventually going to happen to this huge Bedouin tribe? They're going to be wiped out. So, again, what is the common message to Am Yisrael? Are there going to be attacks? Continuing, really, the themes of Perakid Aleph, Perakid Bet. Yes, yes, and yes. And are many of you going to be killed in the series of attacks? Yes, but you have nothing to worry about, because ultimately what's going to happen to each of these respective nations? They will all fall. And therefore we can't leave out Perakid Bet. This is going to be a phenomenal Perak, where we're going to find an anomaly of Nivuah. So those are always exciting. So let's take a look at chapter 22, Masa Gechizayon. This apparently was some type of pronouncement that was given in the valley here of, again, Chizayon. What does Chizayon mean? A chose, and is a vision. So apparently there was some type of Chizayon, some type of message that was given, again, in a visual format, in a particular valley. Please remember that Yeshayahu is a Kohen, who is also the Navi HaMelech. So probably, where is this valley? In Yerushalayim. Very nice. Again, so we don't know exactly where this valley is, but again, it can even be a reference, perhaps, to the entire city of Yerushalayim, because for those who are familiar with the topography of Yerushalayim, what is Yerushalayim? Yerushalayim Harim Savivla. Yerushalayim in itself is a valley surrounded by mountains all around. Beautiful. And therefore, it could be that Yerushalayim itself was nicknamed Gechizayon, the valley of the vision. And sure enough, there are some Parshanim who believe that it's called Chizayon because, meaning the city itself, was a vision. Does anyone know what reference is given to Yerushalayim as a vision? We say this every Monday. And Yifei Nof Misos Kol Ha'aretz, that this is the greatest panorama available. Right, so it could be that Yerushalayim was known as the city of vision, right? Meaning the city is a vision in and of itself, and everyone comes to partake of this vision, to partake of the city. Malach Ifo Kialit Kulach Lagagot. Here he's asking a sarcastic question. What brought you, Yerushalayim, right? He's addressing Amasa to Gechizayon. What brought you, Yerushalayim, to that you're all on the gagot? Again, what does it mean that you're all on the gagot? When do you go to the balconies? Okay, so that's when. Okay, either to look out or what else took place on balconies? Thank you. Dancing on the rooftops. Beautiful. So what is he asking them? Again, notice that he just gave a whole series of all the destruction that's going to be brought upon all the other nations. And then he says, wait a second, what are you doing? Kulach la gagot. Where are you going? Basically, to party on the gagot. Please remember that balconies at that time, again, they all had flat roofs. There were no fancy Florentine roofs. So what did they use their balconies for? Very nice, dancing, partying. Gana, that's how they use them. They would have, by the way, we know even during Tkufa Bayecheni, Simchat Beit HaShemayim, they would use different, no, laundry. Yeah, it doesn't make sense to do on the roof. Why? They hang also generally out of the window or under. Okay, storing food, they also use it for. They also used it for, you know this from the story of Choni HaMa'agel. Also, thank you. In the summers to sleep, they all slept on the rooftop, Yafe Ma'od. And in the winters, why did they make them flat? To collect water. So everyone has their own mini reservoir. They just have to make sure that it's very well tarred, that it's sealed, so obviously it doesn't leak into your house, and there are different stories of it, yes, leaking into the house. But again, here, the rooftop, a flat rooftop, has numerous functions. Here, Yeshayahu is criticizing Yerushalayim for celebrating, right? Either for early celebrations, we're going to see a little bit more of what he means. He says, again, this isn't time for simcha. Again, giving us a certain sense of a transition here. And rather, what is he going to be encouraging them to do? It's time to mourn, because mourning will initiate tshuva, meaning that's exactly it. This is avelut time over here. And that's what he's going to continue to tell them right now. Again, shame on you. Again, what happened to you? Ki alit kulach lagagot, that you're all coming to celebrate. Shu'ot mle'a, ir homiya, kirya aliza, chalalayach, lo chalalei cherev, ve lo matei mochama. Oh, you, again, you're so happy. You're a city of Aliza, new city of happiness. Again, don't you realize your slain are not the slain of the sword? It's true that those who have been killed, I haven't been killed by the sword. Rather, they've all left. All the officers have left. They have run away. They have fled, and your survivors were taken captive. Mirachok barachu. Al kein amarti shu'umini, amarer babechi, al ta'itu l'nachamini, al shol batami. That's why I say, let me weep bitterly. Yerushalayim, and obviously he's speaking to the inhabitants of Yerushalayim, this is not a happy time. And why did they think? What is he referring to? Historically, what is this talking about? Where the people think that it must be that they're secure, and really Yeshayah was coming to tell them, no, this is not a victory, rather, this is a sad sign. And sure enough, the Parshanim explain that what he's trying to tell them, he's going to explain now in the next few psukim, Al kein amarti, ki yom huma umuvusa umuvcha, la'ashem elokim tzva'ot begechi zayon, mekarkar kir v'sho'a el hahar. That here he's referring to when Sancheirv is going to come, when the Assyrians are going to come and fight against Yerushalayim, and we know that, we're going to hear the story about this coming up, the Oyev is going to call out, they're going to scream, and you're going to think that Assyria has left you, again, has left you, and this is victory. But no, what are they really coming to do? We know that they come so close to Yerushalayim, and then they realize that the easier way to conquer is to go down south, that's right, and come up through the flatlands instead of through the mountains. So do you have reason to celebrate? No, giving us a sense that this nevuah is given when? Now, meaning it's given as part of these nevuot already to the time period of Chizkiyahu, and we're going to prove it very shortly. So he's going to say it's not time to celebrate yet. As a matter of fact, all those officers who went out to war against the Assyrians, they're not coming back. Numerous people were taken captive already. Again, this is very sad. Again, all the people here. In the meantime, Elam, again, these are different areas around Eretz Yisrael. They're going to take the mountain men. They had the They bear their shield, basically, and they came to your amakim, referring to where's the area of the amakim, the area of the valleys, the shvelah, the lowlands that they're going to come to. That's where they're going. Again, they're going to storm at the area of Yehuda. Pasuk Ched, vayigalet masach Yehuda, vatabet biyamahu al neshek beit hayar. They're going to storm through Yehuda. They're going to press behind its masach. Anyone know? This is a beautiful terminology. What's a masach? A screen? A shield? What is this referring to? What are the shields of Yehuda? The strong fortifications like Lachish, like Azekah. Again, we know that what are they going to do when they come up from the south? Is Yehuda going to be left alone? No, the Assyrians are going to destroy 48 cities of Yehuda, Beit Shemesh, Azekah, Lachish, the major masachim. They're called a masach, by the way, because the fortifications are meant to be screens before they get to the major city of Yerushalayim. So they're going to trample over all the masachim, David, and do you notice, again, the breaches through the city of David, where you go and collect your water. What water is this referring to? The Brecha HaTachtona, the Shiloach. Excellent. Again, do you think that you're secure? No. Keep in mind that what's the most vulnerable, and this is going to be very important as we learn the chapters, your water sources. Where are the water sources during this time? This is before Chizkiyahu changes it. They're right outside the walls. So what do the Assyrians easily do? They're going to constantly breach through them and deplete your water sources. So that's already what's been going on. Please keep this in mind. You have nothing to celebrate. Again, soon they will. But again, Pasuk Yud, Ve'et Batei Yerushalayim Sfaitam Vatitzu Habatim Levatzer HaChoma. Again, this is what you collected, and you also counted the houses of Yerushalayim. You pulled your houses down in order to fortify your wall. They had to, whatever houses were built on the other side, again, they're going to have to destroy them, and then they're going to rebuild their wall, as we know. And this is now going to tell us a little bit about the plan that we don't know so much about, because this is still part of Masa HaAmim. He's directing this towards Yerushalayim. Things look really great, but are they really great? No. Again, they may have left you temporarily, but look at the situation. Again, your waters are outside. You're going to have to bring them inside your walls. And by the way, we're going to see whether or not Yeshayahu is really happy with this. Right now, is he presenting this as something positive or negative, that you have to bring your water inside your walls? Obviously negative. Again, the Assyrians are coming to attack. Bring them in. You're going to construct this mikvah between the two walls for the waters of the old pool, meaning of the original Canaanite pool, to bring in. That's why we said we're going to have to go to Ir David to actually see this. Elizabeth?
I was always told that you said that in the Chachoma, you got to go to Chizkiyah.
Very nice. Who's he? This is the time period of Chizkiyahu.
Even though the Brecha Tachtona you're saying is before Chizkiyah.
Correct, meaning this Brecha Tachtona is a reference to the waters of the Shiloah where they would empty out outside. That's called the Brecha Tachtona. Very nice. What's the Brecha Eliona? That's what Chizkiyahu changed. Beautiful. Excellent. So now, again, he's noting this is what they're doing, right? You collected this, you collected. Is Yeshayahu mentioning it? Again, please look at this in context. Is this positive or negative?
Negative.
Please. Very nice. He says, look at what you're doing. There's no reason to celebrate. Now, again, we're not going to analyze this 100% now. We're going to wait until we actually see the story when they perform this, giving us a sense that is this nevuah necessarily in its proper chronological place? No. This is still part of the literary collection of Masa HaAmim. We're going to prove it very shortly. And this is the last of the chapters wherein he's going to go back to Yerushalayim. And now, as we mentioned, this is the transition between the time of Ahaz and the time of Chizkiyahu. We're going to continue in Perachav Gimel and Perachav Talid with the stories of Chizkiyahu that precede, again, the story of the Brecha Elyonah and the Brecha Tachtona. So this is really a reference in general to, oh no, you're under attack. And just when you think that the Assyrians are leaving you alone, and we'll have to see exactly what time period this is, they're not. They're coming from the south. They're coming from the Amakim. They're coming from the flatlands. And they're going to destroy your fortifications as they go up north. And that's why you're going to have to protect your water sources. And look, again now, V'lohi batate malosa, but you gave no thought to who is he who has planned it. V'yotre mirachok lo ra'itim. And you took no note of him, again, pasuk yod and yod aleph, umekvasitem volohibatem viyotram irachok lo reitem. You didn't take note of he who created that water source to begin with. Who is this a reference to? Hashem. So note that Yeshayahu is very upset at this. That even though, is that the correct thing to do? If your water sources are being attacked, do you have to bring the water sources inside? Yes, and we're going to see a whole debate Again, between really, what we're going to see Chazal and Yeshayahu, or Yeshayahu here and Yeshayahu later. Here he seems to clearly be chastising the people, primarily Chizkiyahu, for protecting and for changing the channeling of the water. Later on, he's going to say, ah, wonderful, that was fantastic. And Chazal themselves are going to debate whether it was something positive or negative. Here, and this seems to be the major source of Chazal, to say that it was something so terrible. Because what does it mean? What does it mean? You forgot he who created the original water. What? But sometimes you have to change what God did. After all, they're under attack right now, so of course they have to protect their water sources. What does it mean that you forgot Hashem? Now, what did they do? How were they trying to protect themselves? Through all different military strategic mannerisms, without doing what? Without praying to God, without turning to Hashem. So when we look at the story of Chizkiyahu, again, please keep this critique of Yeshayahu in mind and ask ourselves, wait a second, are they relying on God? Are they not relying on God? What happened first? What was the chicken? What was the egg? This is going to stir numerous debates. And that's when God is going to show you when what's going to happen. He's going to cause you to weep and to lament. He is going to make sure, again, then on that day, that you're going to weep and lament, and you're going to lachgor sak. And instead, what are you doing? On the day that you'd expect that people should cry, this now goes back to the beginning of the parak. What are people going to do? Very nice. So when are they going to dance? What is this a reference to? When the Assyrians are going to leave Yerushalayim alone, everyone's going to think that victory, victory. No, but that's exactly it. And this is what they're going to do. They're going to start slaughtering sheep. They're going to eat meat. They're going to drink wine. Eat and drink. Look carefully. Achol v'shato ki machar namut. This is the very famous pasuk. Why are they going to be eating and drinking? Because actually, what are they going to be thinking? That they're going to die. So what is Yeshayahu really criticizing them for? Not that they're so very nice, lack of faith. That's the common theme over here. He says, wait a second, really? Again, when you're under such attack, you shouldn't have necessarily changed the water system. What should you have done? Should have depended more on God. So too, when there's a temporary reprieve, you yourselves know that what's going to happen, that they're going to come back and attack you. Right, and instead, you're going to celebrate, and you're going to think everything's fine. And even if you don't think it's fine, eat and drink, because tomorrow we will die. He says, shame on you. That's not how you deal with imminent attack. You don't eat and drink like the Greeks, like the Romans, like the Babylonians and the other nations, as we saw beforehand. And this seems to be, again, a juxtaposition that is clearly supposed to deliver a theme. The primary theme being here that you are acting like those other nations. That's exactly it. Whereas when you're under attack, what should you always do? Rely on God. That's right. Again, if you see that Hashem's taking care of all the other nations around you, then you should also. And this, by the way, corroborates the idea that maybe Yeshayahu gave some sense of these nevuot even during that time. Don't worry, all these terrible nations, all your adversaries, eventually God is going to get rid of them. And you yourselves should recognize that when you are under attack, again, it's God who's attacking you too, and therefore call out to God. But shame on you. Because then, again, instead you're saying, eat and drink, because tomorrow we will die. Pasuk Yudalid. V'negla bazne Hashem tzva'ot im yichupar ha'avon hazel lachem at mutun amar Hashem elokim tzva'ot. Then what's Hashem going to say? Then Hashem will reveal himself. That's when Hashem told me to my own ears that this sin of yours will never be forgiven. What sin that will never be forgiven? This is so sad that Yeshayahu is even going to tell them that the temporary reprieves that they have, again, unfortunately, they're not going to take advantage of. Instead of using them as an opportunity to call out to God, they're going to adopt the philosophy of other nations. They're going to celebrate out of fear, right? Because tomorrow we will die and Hashem will never forgive you. So that even if there's a temporary reprieve, what eventually is going to happen? You're going to be destroyed. So note that Yeshayahu apparently already knows during what we'll call the height of Chizkiyahu, what does he already know? That because of the people's reaction to everything going on, in the end, they're a sinful people. Giving us the impression that this is really a story that happens later. We have to fill in all the blanks and not to worry because the next chapters will indeed do so. Anna, this is now what I meant by the anomaly. Let's continue and we're going to find a very, very strange... 100%. So notice here, what is Chizkiyahu? This is exactly the time period he's talking about. So what are the people, including Chizkiyahu? So far, what are they being criticized for? Acting like the Goyim, meaning tomorrow we will die, not having sufficient faith, beautiful, and not calling out to God. But that's going to be strange, because between us, are we going to see that Chizkiyahu calls out to God? Yes. So exactly what Yeshayahu is referring to, we don't know yet, so you're going to have to stay tuned. So I'd like you to remember this chapter, because this is exactly what Chazal, what the sages are going to debate. Is Chizkiyahu really that great, or is he not that great? Based on this chapter, even when things seem to be going well, the people just didn't respond properly. So please keep this idea in mind. Soon we're going to see the very positive chapters, and we ourselves are going to be confused, so we're going to have to try to resolve this contradiction somehow. But right now, we don't even know it's a contradiction. Right now, all we know is that the people are responding like the other nations, and God is going to be very angry at them for not having proper faith in him. Pasuk, now comes Pasuk Tedvav. This is one of the most famous chapters because of modern archaeology. So many of you know it by going to Ir David, but this is an anomaly of a nevuah, because we've already mentioned numerous times that what is the phenomenon of a Navi HaMelech? What does he do? What types of nevuah does he deliver? National and, as we've been saying, international nevuot. He delivers relevant nevuot, and that's why so many of Yeshayahu's nevuot are preserved lidorot, because hutzruchu lidorot, because they're mentioned on a national level. What happens to the hundreds of thousands of nevuot delivered by the other hundreds of neviim that are serving as contemporaries to Yeshayahu? They weren't preserved. Why? Because most of them were parochially oriented. They were delivered to individuals. Do we have to hear about nevuot that were delivered to specific individuals? No, the only individual that we're really concerned with is the king, because his individual decisions happen to have national import. So please take a look at this and notice, wait a second, this is so strange. We really don't find, again, any other nevuot that are initiated to individuals in all of nevuah except for this. Every once in a while we'll have an individual who responds to nevuah, like in Amos, you have Amatzia the Kohen, who responds to Amos' nevuah, and then Amos delivers a specific nevuah to him. But even he, again, was obviously a very important figure during his time. Here, it seems that Yeshayahu, and we're not sure why yet, and you're going to figure this out on your own, Yeshayahu, again, is going to go to, again, he's told, go to the Sochein Hazeh. The Sochein was basically the butler, right, the head of the house, right? We'll even call him, again, today, who would this be? Like the Secretary of State, right? This is Pasuk Tetvav now. Go to the butler, Al Shevna Asher Al Habayit. This is Shevna, who's in charge of the entire palace, right? He takes care of all the palatial doings, right? The amount of food that's needed in the palace, the workforces that are in the palace, to make sure that everything runs smoothly, right? The butler of the house, right? That's Shevna. Now, Man Lachapo, Umi Lachapo, Kechatzafta Lacha Po Kever, Chotzvei Marom Kivro, Chokeke Basala Mishkan Lo. You have to appreciate Yeshayahu. Notice that this is all in a sing-song rhyme. All of you follow that with what word appearing in different forms? Po, po, po. Right? Again, po, po, po. Man Lachapo, what are you doing here? Right? Meaning, or what do you have here? Umi Lachapo. Right? Who is here? Kechatzafta Lacha Po. Kever. It's all about, obviously, what is he trying to address about Shevna? Very nice. Yefemo. Shevna's Po. Po is about the here, the now, and again, his place. So Shevna is focusing on the Po. Chotzvei Marom Kivro. What have you done? You have, in your own lifetime, you have already arranged and taken care of hewing your own tomb. Please remember, we're talking about Tkufa Bayit Rishon. So all of you living in Eretz Yisrael for a sufficient amount of time, you should all know this. How did people used to bury themselves? Or how were people buried? Sorry about that. During Tkufa Bayit Rishon, there were caves. Very nice. And you hew it out a little. Very nice. And there was an anteroom. What was in the anteroom? Three stone benches where you would basically, every family had their own little cave, and you would place the people, again, there, their body would decompose over the course of a year, and then ve'yaseif alamav, you would collect the bones and put it, very nice, and that, the little cubby behind, and that's what it meant, that every family, now the important people, what would they do? They would have their own personal cave. Who generally had this? Kings, that's exactly it. Anna, where do you find these, by the way? So this is so fascinating, because anytime you go to Ir David, right, the first thing you do is you go to the rooftop in Ir David. Everyone with me on this virtual tour? Excellent. Today, actually, you just pay 10 shekel extra, and then they give you an introductory movie, which is very nice, but just skip that. And go to the rooftop. And that's where your tour guide should give you an entire topographical and geographical sense of where you are in terms of both the dimensions, north, south, east, west, the proximity to Har HaBayit, the different shvatim, what you're talking about, the Tyropian Valley to your south, and or basically to your west, and the Kidron Valley to your east, right? You're all following this. And then your tour guide is going to point directly across to you to the area of today's very controversial near Barkatz, Shiloach, right? And you're going to look at all the houses of the Solwan, and your tour guide is going to tell you the very disrupting history of the Yemenite Jews who were brought here in the late 1800s, and ultimately they could have settled there, but then, again, now the government basically got them out of there by the 1930s. What a shame, because otherwise we probably could have had control of the Solwan. Okay, there, no statements now. And then you look across, and what does your tour guide tell you? Look, look, Anna, you're all with me on this virtual. You see the caves over there. That's right, one of whom, again, all the way left, is viewed as Bat Paros. Ah, so very nice. So Yad Avshalom is farther down. That's right. It's across. It's at the end of the Kidron Valley by Imek Yehoshaphat. Very nice, but a very similar idea, right? That even though it was obviously much, 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 much later. But again, the idea of the cave of the Queen of Sheba, even though do we have any reason to think that it's hers? No. But whose is it? Some important person. Very nice. Anna, by the way, why did you always bury right outside the city? Meaning these are the distinguished people of Ir David. Very nice. Hold on. You know what I'm going to say? Oh, you don't know this? Ah, no, so I'm being very serious over here. That one is an important person. Everyone says Bat Paro, but we have no idea. That's right. And then you go through the different caves. So that's why I said that. I thought you knew what I was going to talk about. And sure enough, you point out that all the important people were buried outside of the city, because you don't bury in a city. That's why you know when you're coming up Ir David from the back, and they'll show you, oh, Kivrei David, Kivrei HaMelechim, they were probably not there, but probably brought there later on. But Kivrei David are probably as closer to Ir David, probably not across the Silwan. But there, by the way, they're definitely not on Har Tzion, because Har Tzion was not part of ancient Yerushalayim until the time period of Menashe, about 100 years before the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. So, sorry, that's not David, whoever goes to visit there, not David's kever. But probably some important person from Yehuda, makes you feel better. Maybe Menashe, notorious Menashe that you're davening at. But again, in any case, the area, though, then the tour guide is going to tell you that directly across from Ir David, if you're in Area G, no, Eilat Mazar is the palace of David, and you're looking directly across. There, again, archaeologists found a slab of stone in ancient Hebrew with the words Po, 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 mentioned three times. You don't know this? I thought I'm just repeating this for you. And with the name Shevna HaSofer. Oh, I was going to Xerox this, and I said, no, they're all going to think that, because you've all said, okay, then I'm Xeroxing it for you. I'm sorry. I'm going to give you a nice slab of stone, again, not two-dimensional form. Again, it's fascinating. And they found it inside the kever. This was found in the late 70s, when they first started the work on Ir David, meaning they worked in the Silwan before they worked on Ir David, right? They thought that Silwan was really the place of Mosav. Directly across, meaning the Ma'ara, if you're in Area G, it's a little lower, so you can't see it. So if you're on that rooftop, which is higher up, then you have to point a little bit down, meaning it's like this from the rooftop or like this from Area G. And you're basically, that's the cave where they found the slab of stone when you come in, giving us the impression that what did Shevna do? He decided to promote himself. Now, the truth is that important people, it seemed that what did they do? They wanted to make sure that they had a nice mausoleum when they died. That's right. Again, people today do this too. And however, Shevna apparently is going to be criticized. Most Parshanim explain based on the juxtaposition, because he was one of those who was promoting the merriment of the people. And what did he tell himself? Look, we're going to die. So what am I going to do? I'm going to, very nice, I'm going to arrange for myself a beautiful tomb. And this way, when I die, again, and now I'm going to die by the hands of the Assyrians, at least I know that my place is supported. If he's an important person, he's the butler of the house of Ir David, then what are people going to do? They're going to take heed from him, and they're going to say, oh my gosh, look, he really thinks he's going to die. And he's taking care of his his funeral procession already, giving us the impression that that would send a terrible negative message to the people themselves, and that's why he's going to be criticized. The Midrashim explain that he's criticized for his arrogance. Again, please keep in mind that a lot of people did this. So, nonetheless, Chazal say, look how arrogant he is, that he's arranging for himself. Who does he think he is? The Melech gets his own tomb, but everyone else has their family tombs. Who does he think he is to do this? Why is this fascinating, though? Because you walk into the Kever, and sure enough, Yeshayahu is going to tell him, you know what, you're going to be demoted right now, and you're going to die. It seems that he died with that Nevuah of Yeshayahu transcribed. So here we have an actual proof for, number one, the Nevuah, for the existence of someone named Shevna HaSofer, Asher al-Habayit, by the way, meaning part of it is, so there it's written as HaSofer, because in Malachim Bet, he's called HaSofer. There he's called, here he's called HaSochein. Some, in fact, explain, based on Malachim Bet, and we're going to see that he's mentioned together with Eliakim in just a moment, that the Sochein means the butler, the Sofer is the scribe. Some say that he was actually demoted. That maybe he's not going to be killed off right away, but here he's the Sochein, in Malachim Bet he's the Sofer, maybe he was demoted first, or maybe it's a different Shevna. One is HaSochein, the other one is the Sofer. But the one across from Yer David, because you have the po, this seems to be the Nevuah directly related to him. Very nice. It seems that it was written after he died. That's right. Meaning saying, look, he really died based on Yeshayahu's critique of him right now. Isn't that fascinating?
Where is that stuff now?
Israel Museum. It's there. I mean, you could really, but I'll show you. Wait, it may even be here. I hope it's here. Yes, here it is. Of course it's here. This is it. This is what it looks like. Part of it, as you see, is wiped out. This is what it says. Zot, and it's wiped out a little, but it looks like Kivrat. It says the following. Yud He Vav, which, again, it's hard to see, but it, again, just leave that. Asher Al Habayit, very strange term. What's Asher Al Habayit? The butler of the house. Ein Po, now look carefully at what it says. Ein Po, Kesef Vizahav. There is no money over here. Then again, very nice. Please keep in mind that the primary profession during this time period is grave robbers. Ki im atzmota ve'atzmot amata. Again, his bones and his wife's bones. Ata arur ha'adam asher yiftach etzot. And cursed be the person who opened it up. Meaning, generally, people really did bury themselves with great jewels, but this is basically through the incorporation of the word po. Why do you need to say po? Of course it's here. Reference to the nevuah of po, malacha po. You have nothing, Shevna. He's going to die with nothing. And here it seems that, what is the yud he vav? Again, it's partially wiped out. So what could it be? Or yud shin. The hey and the shin are really just missing a line in between, the shin, that it's really referring to Shevna Asher Alabayit. Not, sorry, it doesn't say HaSofer or HaSochein. Shevna Asher Alabayit. And again, because you don't have any other person who's called Asher Alabayit. And because Po, in Lecha Po, and to show that there's nothing here, referring to the fact that he was punished. So let's take a look and see, what is his punishment? Again, through the juxtaposition, as a direct result of encouraging the merriment and the anticipation of death, not relying on Hashem, and he's the butler of the house. Who do you think you are? Hinei Hashem etaltecha. What is Hashem going to do? Hashem's going to shake you up. Taltela gever ve'otcha ator. He's going to shake you and then wrap you up. Tzanof yitznafachat nefa, kadur al eretz, rachavat yadayim. Indeed, he's going to wind you about him like a headdress, like a turban. Shama tamut v'shamam rakavat kvodecha, klon beit adonecha. In the end, you're going to be held off. Again, you're going to die. And there, the chariots will bear your body. Meaning, you're not even going to be able to use this tomb. So then, that doesn't support what we found archaeologically. But Yeshayahu doesn't necessarily have to mean literally. You're not going to use the tomb. You're going to be carried off somewhere else. He either means he'll be demoted from his position, or he means that he'll die without anything. Right? That seems to be the idea. Klon beit adonecha. You're going to be an embarrassment. V'hadavticha mimatzavecha umimamadcha yaharsecha. And this is what seems to tell us. I am going to demote you, or basically cast you off from your position. You're going to be torn down from your position. And look at the next pasuk. Vayabayamahu v'karati ladi l'Eliakim ben Chilkiyahu. And sure enough, we know that there are, again, Eliakim ben Chilkiyahu's I'm going to appoint someone else as the butler. V'bashtiv kutantacha v'amnatacha chaskenu memshaltacha item biyado v'yalav v'yoshev yushalim v'levet Yehuda. He's going to take over your position because you are distracting the people. So, and sure enough, in Malachim Bet, we find Eliakim ben Chilkiyahu asher al habayit v'shevna hasofer. So that's where we have to know, is it a different Shevna over there, or Shevna Hasochein was demoted to Shevna Hasofer? Most say that there are two separate Shevnas. That Shevna, again, that this Shevna is going to be completely wiped out from his post. V'natati mafteach beit David al shechmo, he is going to be the correct leader. He's going to be the head of the household. And by the way, what did Shevna, what could he actually do? Not only secure his own kever, but also, if he's the butler, he probably arranged for a lot of the parties taking place. So shame on you for casting the wrong perception amidst the people. And therefore, Hashem is going to give the house to someone else. Ve'in soger v'sagar ve'in poteach. You're not going to be in charge anymore. He was in charge of opening and closing the gates. Utzkativ yateh b'mkom ne'eman ve'yal l'chiseh avod l'veit aviv. So that ultimately, the kingship can be secure. Again, shame on you. Again, whoever is going to have the keys, he should have the seat of honor. I'm going to place him firmly instead of you. V'talu alav kol kvo beit aviv ha-tetzaim v'atviyot kol klei katan miklei ha-adanot v'ad kol klei ha-nevalim. He's going to be in charge of all the musical instruments, giving us the sense that Shevna was really a big man on the scene before he is punished here by Yishayahu, again, because of his improper perception. Bayom ha-hu ne'um Hashem tzva'ot tamush ha-yateid ha-tkua b'makom ne'man v'nigda'a v'nafla v'nechvat ha-masa sh'arlaha. So again, Hashem can take someone who's in a very, very fixed position and completely cast him out. That's exactly what's going to happen to you, Shevna. So we have an anomaly of an individual nevuah, again, to a specific person, which we generally don't find preserved in nevuah, but the whole idea here is to show us how Shevna himself is probably responsible not only for the audacious behavior of the people, but also for their excessive merriment at a time when they really should have been calling out to Hashem. And with this then, we're going to end the Masa with Masa Tzor, and finally, again, the Tzkufav Chizkiyahu, we end the literary device over here, the literary intermission. Tzor, again, the Phoenician capital, Ava, Tyre, and Sidon, basically Tzor and Sidon are going to be mentioned as the last ones on the northern border of Am Yisrael, and then we're going to have to finally fill in the blanks for the very beginning of the time period of Chizkiyahu. Shavuot.